Handle on that car fire eastbound 580 at the Stonecut overpass. That right lane still taken away. See major delays into Dublin. So big crash San Jose involving three vehicles eastbound 237 before Zanker. At least one lane blocked here. It's solid from Lawrence Expressway. And San Lorenzo, a three-car pileup on southbound 880 at the 238 split. It's in the two left lanes. That's backing up into Oakland. Julie Deppish for KQED.
And traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from UCSF Health, collaborating with Marin Health in the North Bay to deliver exceptional orthopedic care, including surgical and non-surgical options for spine conditions. UCSFHealth.org/MarinHealth. The Asian Art Museum. Phoenix Kingdoms, the last splendor of China's Bronze Age, uses digital technologies to reimagine a culture buried by imperial history for centuries. Tickets at asianart.org.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. Tracy residents are trying to find some sense of normalcy after the Corral fire tore through the area over the weekend. KQED's Aaron Baldessari spoke to a few of them.
On Saturday, Lucille Holloway saw the sky go dark and smoke fill the air. She dropped everything to evacuate and wait out the fire at a friend's house. Her home wasn't damaged, but she's still reeling from the shock.
It's just trying to, I call it, come down.
Today, she went out to grab some milk, a small step toward normal.
Go in, you're going to put it away. These are big steps right now, but it's true, that's how you feel.
A patch of grass on her front lawn is burned, a reminder of how close the fire came.
You realize how close somebody could have died.
Holloway says she's grateful to the firefighters and police for helping make sure no one did. I'm Aaron Baldessari, KQED News.
Fire officials today say the Corral fire is around 75% contained. It's burned more than 14,000 acres and one home. Activists behind a protest that shut down the Israeli consulate in San Francisco today say 67 people have been arrested. The activists say they were protesting in defense of Palestinian lives and what they're calling a normalization of genocide. In a statement, Israeli Consul General Marco Sermoneta called the group a mob of pro-Hamas rioters and thanked SFPD for their swift response. SFPD has not responded to a request for comment. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
A heat advisory kicking off tomorrow morning at 8, and it'll run through midnight Thursday night. Expect temperatures to reach the upper 90s inland. I'm Sandy Altaus. Good afternoon. This is KQED-FM San Francisco, KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento. The time is 4 p.m.
Marketplace is supported by Betterment, the automated investing platform that helps make it easy to be invested for the long term. Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk.
Not too hot, not too cold. Goldilocks, but for interest rates. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Amazon Business, helping provide a smarter, easier way to get the supplies businesses need to thrive. Amazon Business, your partner for smart business buying. And by NinjaOne, the endpoint management platform that automates the hardest parts of IT and helps your employees be more productive and secure no matter where they work at NinjaOne.com. And by The Economist, devoted to providing independent journalism that makes sense of the news shaping the world. More at economist.com or with The Economist app, newsletters, and podcasts.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 3rd of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. As the Federal Reserve thinks about interest rates, which it will do Tuesday and Wednesday next, Chair Powell and the gang are, of course, weighing the data. That's what they tell us all the time. They're also looking for signs that the place they've put their main interest rate, the federal funds rate, it's called, a bit above 5% right now. They want to make sure that that's actually doing what they want it to do, slowing the economy without stopping it. That sweet spot, in turn, depends on what in normal times would be the interest rate at which the economy is not running too hot, but also not running too cold. It's called the neutral rate. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains by way of getting us going, the neutral rate is a bit tricky to nail down.
Imagine a world where inflation is fully under control. The economy is growing at just the right speed, not losing steam, not overheating, just right. The interest rate that would keep all those things in balance is called the natural or neutral rate.
The neutral rate is the Fed's kind of guiding compass.
Matthew Pignotti is a senior analyst at Capital Advisors Group. If you are trying to sail north, you might have to steer east or west sometimes with currents and wind, but your compass will help you get back on track. It is the same for the Federal Reserve.
And for the Fed, over the long run, the short-term interest rate might deviate from the neutral rate, but in the long run, kind of that's what they want to get to.
Sometimes things happen. Inflation flares up and the Fed has to slow the economy down, or there's a financial crisis and the Fed has to get the economy moving. Joseph Gagnon is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
And when they want to slow the economy down, they raise the rate above the natural rate. When they want to speed the economy up, they lower the rate below the natural rate.
There is one problem with this North Star, this shining perfect interest rate on a hill.
You cannot measure it directly.
It's theoretical. There is no simple formula that will spit it out.
But in hindsight, over time, you can see roughly where it is.
If you look back in time and the economy was stable, then whatever interest rate it had was probably the right one.
The error around the estimates, because the neutral rate is not observable, the error bands for these models are very wide.
David Rogel is a fixed income portfolio manager at BlackRock. Right now, the Fed believes the neutral interest rate is 2.5%. That is a lot lower than the 5.5% we currently have. So one day, when inflation is fixed, the idea is we will get back down to 2.5%, which would affect new mortgages and car loans and credit cards.
But I think what you're hearing from the Fed, the communications, is that there's less certainty about that.
The mystical Goldilocks neutral interest rate can change, depending on a lot of factors, population growth, productivity, federal spending, and it may be changing now. Again, Matthew Pignotti at Capital Advisors Group.
I think that there's a lot of good evidence that it's rising.
For starters, we've had high interest rates for a year now, and the economy has barely battled ash, no recession, no slowdown. So maybe the normal times interest rate of the Fed's dreams is actually higher than it used to be. But also, maybe not. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Shining interest rate on a hill. I kind of like that one. On Wall Street to start this week, a little up, a little down, stasis of sorts. Ahead of the big May jobs report coming to us on Friday, we will have the details when we do the numbers. The thing about the neutral rate that Sabri was just telling us about, and what the neutral rate itself is telling us about how much the Fed is actually putting the brakes on this economy, is that the price of money, which is just another way to think about interest rates, trickles down through every moving part in this economy. Today's case in point, spending on construction. We got new numbers from the Census Bureau this morning on construction spending for the month of April, basically flat from March. And going back to the start of this year, it's barely budged after a healthy 14% run-up in spending last year. Why the slowdown? Marketplace's Daniel Ackerman took a look around the construction economy to find out.
This year's flatline in construction spending was kind of inevitable, said Anirban Basu, CEO of Sage Policy Group.
I think it's interest rates finally starting to catch up with this industry.
The Federal Reserve started raising interest rates back in 2022 to stem inflation. Basu says at first, the higher borrowing costs didn't really affect builders.
Because people have signed contracts, they've made decisions to move forward, and it takes a while for those higher interest rates to interrupt the economy.
But he says that interruption may have arrived. Spending on the construction of commercial buildings was down in April, along with multifamily housing.
What we're seeing right now is the end of an apartment building boom.
Robert Dietz is chief economist at the National Association of Home Builders. He says last winter saw 1 million apartments under construction.
The highest unit count since May of 1973.
Now, though, that number's down by more than a third. He says in part because developers are having a harder time financing new buildings. But not all construction is so sensitive to borrowing costs.
If you've flown in any airport lately, you've seen a lot of construction.
Catherine Thompson is CEO of Thompson Research Group. She says transportation infrastructure, from air to rail to roads, has taken off thanks in part to recent federal legislation. Also being built, water systems and industrial construction like factories.
They were candidly pretty boring categories up until now.
She expects factories to keep getting built, even if overall construction remains flat for a while. I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
We've been reporting on this program for years now that home prices in many parts of this country are at record highs. And with interest rates being where they are, 7%-ish, home ownership is only getting harder for a lot of would-be buyers. The tax code has been of some help. The mortgage interest deduction has made it easier for some homeowners to swallow the purchase price of a new home. It is kind of a classic tax expenditure, that interest deduction, a tax break that the government uses to incentivize certain behaviors like, in this case, home ownership. Question is, does it actually do what it is supposed to do? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that story.
On a rainy day, about an hour outside of D.C., realtor Wendy Wright is prepping for an open house.
So we're going to take our shoes off as we enter the house just because it has been well staged and cleaned before everybody comes through.
Wright is a realtor with Keller Williams Metro Center in Virginia, but she's on the other side of the D.C. suburbs, setting out balloons and bottles of water at a 5-bedroom, 4.5-bath home.
This is brand new construction built in 2021. The deck on the back of the house, a full master bedroom. Our primary bedroom, as we call it today.
The home is listed at almost $900,000, but unless the buyer pays in cash, interest will make the house cost several times that over the life of a typical 30-year mortgage. So the government tries to help.
The home mortgage interest deduction was introduced in the tax code really as a way to try to help with the goal of helping folks have a more attainable home ownership.
Garrett Watson is a senior policy analyst at the Tax Foundation.
Though it does reduce the cost for homeowners who do claim it, it does come with some trade-offs.
For example, you can only take the mortgage interest deduction if you're the one taxpayer in 9 who itemizes on your tax returns and if the mortgage interest you pay is more than the standard deduction of just under $30,000 for married couples filing jointly this year.
The average deduction usually goes to people earning $100,000 to over $200,000 a year.
Mohammed Alameldine is a policy associate at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. He says it's wealthier people who both itemize and pay enough interest to get the deduction.
For people earning over $200,000 a year, this reduces their taxes by $5,300. While people earning $100,000 or less see an average deduction of about $300.
The 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the Trump tax law, changed how much of a mortgage is eligible for the interest deduction. It used to be $1 million. It became $750,000. But, points out realtor Wendy Wright, nowadays,
at higher interest rates, your interest on your mortgage is higher. Hence, you're probably taking a more of a deduction at a lower price point because of the interest rate being higher.
Still, the vast majority of people don't benefit from it. And many economists argue there's not much evidence that the mortgage interest deduction actually gets more people to buy homes instead of renting. It just makes homes more expensive. Plus, says Garrett Watson at the Tax Foundation, all of those deductions for big, expensive houses going primarily to wealthy people, they cost the federal government money.
Every year, about $30 billion. And if that deduction were pared back further or eliminated, that revenue could be used to lower rates elsewhere or to go and fund other priorities.
And the hit to federal revenues from the mortgage interest deduction is set to jump at the end of 2025 when the provision in the 2017 tax law expires, unless Congress changes or extends it. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Dan Ackerman was talking a minute ago about flat construction spending for April. We got a different big spending data point last Friday, consumer spending, which softened a little bit in April, that after holding pretty steady for 3 months. So with signs that the consumer might be slowing down a bit, we decided to give two of our retail regulars a call.
Hi, my name is Larry Groves, and I am the co-founder of the Growing Groves Plant Shop. My name is Ricky Barossa, and I'm also a co-founder of the Growing Groves here in Davis, California. Business is good, I think. So the shop is doing well. It's interesting now to be open for 2 years and kind of navigate the current economic climate. The month that we're in is a very interesting time because, you know, we're in a college town and a lot of graduates are going through commencement ceremonies right now. Our slow season, it definitely is like when people are graduating, like summer, and then we ramp back up back in September. During early spring, we kind of sit down with each other and talk about things that, like, you know, what can we do to supplement, you know, the income loss? We start talking about, oh, should we, you know, start, you know, reining back our expenses? So that's always the hardest conversation for me because I don't want to slow down. As the one who controls the finances, I'm like, okay, I love his ideas, but sometimes you have to rein them in. I'll bring up an idea. Hey, I think we should get this for the store. Okay. We'll think about it maybe in a couple months. And I'm like, I already ordered it. So
I think that's when my like corporate side comes out and I'm like, okay, let's, you know, bring up a Google sheet and, you know, have everything outlined and see if we can do it. But it's fun to go through that together.
Yeah. The biggest challenge for me personally is burnout.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I like really hit a wall kind of like early spring where I was just constantly going. One way that I tried to like combat that is just wake up every morning, come to the store and just write out a to-do list. Cause it just for a while felt like I wasn't getting anything accomplished.
Yeah. I think seeing him go through all this as my other job, my main job, like ramps up, I don't have enough time to like help him as much as I can or I want to. When we do have like a day together, we're like, oh my God, like we can rest.
And then it's like, we just talk about the store all day
mm-hmm.
and just be like, okay, well, we could try this.
But the days where we can just do nothing and
they're amazing.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah.
My goals for this year is to really work on like content and branding, and I just want things to run more smoothly. Like I want like our everyday, you know, we have an SOP that we follow. We have like calendar dates that are readily available for everyone.
Yeah, I think we have a better understanding of what it means to run a business and the balance that you need to have to keep running the business. future outlook, I think, is, you know, positive. So we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
Larry Groves and Ricky Barossa running the Growing Groves Plant Shop up in Davis, California. Coming up,
they had the ability to crank out a reinvention of the peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
$1 billion worth. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 115 points today, about 0.3%, finished at 38,571. The NASDAQ gained 93 points, 0.6%, closed at 16,828. S&P 500 added 5 points, about a 0.1%, 52.83 there. GameStop soared 21% today. The meme stock rose after a social media post from Keith Gill, the investor known as Roaring Kitty, on Reddit. It appeared to show that he had 5 million shares of video game retailer. Meme stock AMC jumped 11%. Both stocks were hit by a technical glitch, by the way, in the New York Stock Exchange earlier that showed incorrect prices for a number of stocks, including Berkshire Hathaway A shares. BRK is the ticker today. Down 0.6% at the end of the day. At one point this morning, shown wrongly as being down 99.7%. That, my friends, would have been a bargain. BRKA trades today at $631,000 a share. Let's buy two, huh? Spotify tuned up 5 2/3% today after announcing a premium subscription price hike from July, the second raise in a year for the streaming service. Bond prices were up. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.39%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital markets solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. And by Bitwarden Password Manager for Business, designed for those who work at home and those who work at work. Learn more at bitwarden.com/business. And by Amazon Business, from small business to big enterprise and everything in between, Amazon Business helps simplify the supplies buying process. Amazon Business, your partner for smart business buying.
Support for KQED comes from the Chef Anne Foundation. California school food professionals are using their skills to make school meals healthier and tastier. Learn more at schoolfoodpros.org. Grant provided by California Community Colleges, Chancellor's Office. The San Mateo County Fair. Fairgoers can learn about the origins of toys at the Toytopia exhibit. And as always, there's farm animals, butterfly exhibit, and pig races, June 1st through the 9th. Tickets at sanmateocountyfair.com. Coming up at 4:30 on All Things Considered.
After author Michael Crichton died, his wife Sherry came across an unfinished novel. Then James Patterson finished it. A collaboration from beyond the grave on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's from 4:30 till 6:30 on KQED Public Radio.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is going to get hot out here in parts of the West this week, 120 degrees hot in some of the deserts. It's the first big heat wave of what is expected to be another abnormally hot summer in most of the country. Last year was, as you know, the hottest on record, as well as the deadliest, and some jobs can be especially risky. Construction, farming, logistics, to name just a couple. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more now on shoring up workplace protections for heat.
More than 400 workers died due to exposure to heat between 2011 and 2021, according to federal records. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration has been crafting new heat-specific rules at the direction of President Biden since 2021. We don't know exactly what those rules will be, but they would likely trigger things like required rest and water breaks when the heat index reaches certain thresholds.
Nobody disputes that overexposure to heat is a hazard.
Mark Friedman is vice president of workplace policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which has pushed back against early proposals. He says current general guidelines for rest, water, and shade are effective. If OSHA sets stricter thresholds to, say, a heat index of 80 degrees, he says businesses with heat-generating equipment would find it difficult to maintain temperatures.
Such a regulation could really impose a lot of costs on employers and, in some cases, perhaps jeopardize their ability to stay in business.
The agency appears to be close to releasing its final proposal, says Debbie Berkowitz, who was at OSHA during the Obama administration and is now a fellow at Georgetown.
But they have many, many steps they have to go through. It could take another couple of years.
It takes an average of 7 years for OSHA to create a new national standard. 5 states have created their own, and several more are close to adopting them, says Anastasia Christman of the National Employment Law Project.
Part of it is workers have found their voice and their power in the last, say, decade, and have really started to understand that the best way to address these problems is to speak out about them together.
But Texas and Florida have preemptively banned local jurisdictions from enacting new rules. And in California, the first state to regulate heat in the workplace, a long-planned extension of protections to indoor sites has stalled over uncertainty about how much it will cost the state. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Consider the peanut butter and jelly sandwich, a staple of the elementary school lunchbox and a great snack for adults everywhere, a classic that needs no improvement. Well, maybe, but if you want to build a brand, you gotta innovate, so enter the Uncrustable, a PB&J with, just like it sounds, the crusts cut off. More than 25 years old and on the cusp of being a brand worth 10 digits. Clint Rainey wrote about it the other day at Fast Company. Clint, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kai. Thanks for having me.
Uncrustables, basically a peanut butter and jelly sandwich of sorts, is going to be a billion-dollar brand. Are you kidding me?
It's pretty nuts to think about, isn't it?
Yes. How?
I mean, I think that this is one of those, you know, great success stories. You have a company, Smucker, that has for over 100 years, like 125 years, been producing these like basic pantry staples, peanut butter, coffee, baking mixes, shortening, and realized at a certain point that they had jelly, they had peanut butter, they could probably figure out bread. And if they just put those things together, they had the ability to crank out a reinvention of the peanut butter and jelly sandwich that, you know, appealed to not just parents for kids' lunches, but athletes who are looking for, you know, a quick way to refuel.
Yeah, we'll get to the athletes in a second. So we should say, first of all, Smucker's did not invent the Uncrustables, but they did sort of launch it. They've been around for a long time. It's not like Uncrustables are new, right? They've been around for 25, 26 years.
Right, right. The reason that I wrote this story was that these things were just starting to pop up everywhere. Mm-hmm. I was seeing them on social media. I was seeing them at halftime shows, Charles Barkley coming on, you know, during a basketball game, talking about how he like stocks them in his freezer. So Smucker purchased the brand from two dads in the Midwest in 1998. They, you know, they went straight into cranking away on these things. And, you know, the expansion of the brand and the growth of the product has been almost entirely organic. So organically, people were snatching these things up, but there was no marketing behind it yet.
Well, and look, you don't need marketing when Charles Barkley is talking about him in a halftime show and Travis Kelce, for crying out loud, is saying he eats more of them than anything else. I mean, this thing has, look, I get that it's convenient and all that, but fundamentally, it's peanut butter and jelly sandwich, right?
No kidding. And I think it sort of became, I don't want to call it an inside joke, but I mean, sort of, right? Mm-hmm. Like there was some reporting that the Baltimore Ravens ate 7,500 of these things last NFL season. You know, they just sort of become this like cultural artifact, especially in professional sports where it's, you know, just something everybody can kind of laugh about.
Have you, or here's the kicker question. Have you tried one of these things?
I have, and I will admit with some level of embarrassment that I had not before I started writing the story. But I went out, I live in New York City, and you know, there's a lot of things that are difficult to find in New York. I did not struggle to find Uncrustables. I had advance warning that they were going to be in the frozen section, which I was told by multiple people at Smucker is a source of confusion for consumers. They don't necessarily think to make a beeline for the freezer aisle.
Are you supposed to microwave them to thaw them, or what do you do?
Apparently, absolutely not. But there is an entire cottage industry on Reddit and other
forums online of people who are suggesting ways that you can improve them. And that involves air fryers and microwaving. And it's insane. But some people want to remove the tiny little crimped edges that...
You're uncrusting the uncrustable?
It's insane, right? I mean, at that point, you have to assume it just oozes out the side. But that I didn't try, so I can't swear to it.
Peanut butter and jelly. It is ripe for disruption. Clint Rainey, he's a contributing writer at Fast Company, talking about uncrustables. Clint, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering small business owners protection for what they've worked hard to build with over 30 customizable coverages. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. And by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service from 13 U.S. gateways to Frankfurt, Germany, plus seamless connections to over 100 European travel destinations at condor.com.
This final note on the way out today, another entry in the private equity buys up an iconic American company file. CNBC is reporting today that Skydance, which is a consortium backed by, among others, KKR, has come to terms with Paramount on a takeover. It's an $8 billion deal, give or take, waiting only on a sign-off from Sherry Redstone, whose holding company National Amusements owns Paramount. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Lise Hassan, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All Things Considered is up next. First, though, Julie Depesch is here with something happening on the road in Palo Alto.
A new trouble here on North 101 before University Avenue. We've got a couple of vehicles blocking the exit lane. That'll back you up to Oregon Expressway. Car fire is finally out on the Altamont Pass, so lanes are open. East 580 at Stonecut Overpass. That's jammed into Dublin. And a new crash in San Jose, southbound Guadalupe Parkway, after the 280 interchange. That's the left lane. Traffic stop from Airport Parkway. Julie Depesch for KQED.
And traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from Supermicro and NVIDIA. Accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA AI Enterprise software platform. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack scale innovations. Listen to KQED throughout each weekday for clues to our 5:48 p.m. news quiz. When you hear the quiz question, go to kqed.org/radionewsquiz to enter your answer for a chance to win a two-night stay with our sponsor, Canyon Ranch Woodside. And good luck. This is KQED-FM San Francisco. The time now is 4:30.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, climate change is here, changing life on our planet.
So why does Hollywood produce so few movies that take on the subject?
It is an incredibly low bar, and then you actually look at the number of films, the percentage of films that are passing it, and it's still shockingly low.
That's ahead. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Biden has outlined a three-phase plan to end Israel's war in Gaza, but the plan has yet to be formally agreed to by Hamas or Israel. As NPR's Kat Lonsdorf tells us, civilians in Gaza are eager to see the deal happen.
The plan includes a six-week ceasefire and the possibility for Palestinians displaced from North Gaza to go back home for the first time in the war. NPR producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, spoke with Rima Al-Aqa, a mother of four currently living in a tent in Mawasi near Rafah in southern Gaza. It's a difficult life, she says, but she's hopeful about the possibility of being able to go home.
Actually, this is a dream for us, actually, to just return to our houses in the north of Gaza and to stop the war, actually, the fighting, all these things, because our bodies are very, very tired, you know, and our dream right now, actually, to stop the war and this hard life. So I hope America to do that and stop the war.
Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Prosecutors have dropped felony charges against a white Minnesota state trooper who fatally shot a black motorist last year during a traffic stop. From Minnesota Public Radio, Brent Williams reports.
Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty said she made the decision to drop the charges against Trooper Ryan Londrigan in light of new defense evidence. Defense attorneys say Londrigan would testify that he believed Ricky Cobb II was reaching for Londrigan's gun before the trooper fired two shots at Cobb as he drove away, and that he feared for his life and for the life of another trooper who was reaching into Cobb's car. Moriarty said body camera video of the incident didn't prove or disprove the trooper's account. An attorney for Cobb's family has said he believes prosecutors bowed to pressure from law enforcement groups to drop the case. For NPR News, I'm Brant Williams in St. Paul.
And this is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. CAL FIRE is still investigating the cause of a major wildfire this weekend that started at a site maintained by Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. KQED's Dan Brecky reports.
The Alameda County Fire Department was the first to respond to the Corral Fire Saturday afternoon. A fire dispatcher advised arriving crews that active power lines were down in the area. CAL FIRE Battalion Chief Josh Silvera says that's one of many possible causes that investigators will look at.
We're going to rule out power lines down. We're going to rule out wind causing power lines to slap, vehicle exhaust, trailer chains dragging and creating a spark. The investigation team is going to do everything in their power to figure out what truly caused this.
The 14,000-acre fire burned one home and closed a 15-mile stretch of Interstate 580 for a full day. I'm Dan Brecky, KQED News.
For the second time in recent weeks, the state's Public Employment Relations Board has denied a request from the University of California for an injunction against an ongoing strike by graduate students and other academic workers. UC maintains the strike is illegal, and a statement from the union says it's time for UC to face reality and negotiate with the union on issues relating to campus protests and free speech. Workers at three more UC campuses are now joining the strike over alleged unfair labor practices. UC San Diego and Santa Barbara today, and Irvine starting on Wednesday. UC Santa Cruz, Davis, and UCLA were already on strike. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for KQED comes from the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts. And support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, introducing the all-electric EV6 with a vehicle-to-load function that turns the EV6 into a mobile power source. More info at kia.com. We'll be in a heat advisory starting tomorrow morning around the Bay Area at 8 a.m. through Thursday night. You can expect some triple digits in the furthest inland areas. Tomorrow in San Francisco, expect a high of 78 degrees. Support for NPR comes from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And by the listeners of KQED. The time is 4:35.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Today on Capitol Hill, Republican lawmakers grilled Dr. Anthony Fauci, the former senior government advisor during the pandemic, grilled him about the origins of the coronavirus. It was a tense hearing. At times, it grew rancorous.
We should be recommending you to be prosecuted. You belong in prison, Dr. Fauci.
That is Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene. And joining me now to distill the more than 3 hours of testimony from Dr. Fauci is NPR science correspondent Jeff Brumfield. Hey there, Jeff.
Hi there.
So this today, it marks the culmination of a long investigation led by House Republicans. Remind us what exactly they are trying to find out.
Yeah, in a nutshell, they're trying to establish whether COVID came from a lab or whether it came from nature. Now, I'd say the majority of scientists still believe this was an outbreak from bats, similar to the original SARS outbreak in 2003. But many other people, particularly on the political right, think it may have escaped from a laboratory in Wuhan, China.
Right. And as we have noted, too, this has been debated and discussed and argued over for a while now. Did they get at anything new in today's hearing?
Not really. So here's the thing. The question of whether COVID came from a Chinese lab has gained traction in recent years. Some intelligence agencies here in the U.S. think it may have. But many House Republicans want to take things a step further. They want to prove not only COVID came from a Chinese lab, but that an American nonprofit was behind it, and that it was funded by Fauci's agency, the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases. Now, it's true, a nonprofit was working on viruses at the lab, but Fauci denied that work caused the pandemic.
It is molecularly impossible for those viruses to have evolved or being made into SARS-CoV-2.
And I should say, this theory often paints Fauci as the supervillain behind it all, that he somehow engineered the virus while trying to cover it up. He denies that, of course. Here's an exchange with New York Republican Nicole Malliotakis.
Today you testified that you did not suppress the lab leak theory, yet in the past you have said, quote, I've heard these conspiracy theories.
Actually, I've also been very, very clear that I don't think the concept of there being a lab leak is inherently a conspiracy theory. What is conspiracy is it was a lab leak and I was parachuted into the CIA like Jason Bourne and told the CIA that they should really not be talking about a lab leak.
And Fauci also refuted other aspects of the supervillain theory, like he somehow profited from the pandemic.
Okay, so that is how Republicans spent this hearing. How about Democrats?
Democrats spent a lot of time defending Fauci and praising him for his work. I think the ranking Democrat Paul Ruiz of California really summed up their feeling about the hearing process.
House Republicans have abdicated their responsibility to objectively examine how COVID-19 came to be and instead weaponized concern about a lab-related origin to fuel sentiment against our nation's scientists and public health officials for partisan gain.
Fauci's now 83, retired, and he told the committee that he and his family still get death threats.
Jeff, the pandemic, as you know, started, what, 4 or 5 years ago? Just remind us briefly, why does it still matter to figure out where it came from?
Well, there's a lot at stake here. Lab origins means lab safety is in need of an overhaul, and there's also a question of accountability with China. Natural origins means we need better disease surveillance, better rules for working with animals. So there's huge policy choices to be made here. There is just a lot at stake.
NPR's Jeff Brumfield. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
This fall, millions of people will be eligible to cast ballots in the general election for the first time. Most of those will be young people who have turned 18 since the 2022 midterms. But it also includes new U.S. citizens naturalized in that same time period. So what impact could these voters have? NPR's Elena Morris here to explain. Hi there.
Hey.
So Elena, just for starters, how big of a group of people are we talking about?
Well, since the 2020 election, an estimated 3.5 million adults of voting age have been naturalized in the U.S., and that's according to the University of California, San Diego. Over a third of them are from countries in Asia, followed by North and South America, and then Africa. And of course, within this larger exclusive club of new voters, new citizens are small compared to the 8 million Gen Zers who will be voting in their first presidential election. But 3.5 million is still pretty noteworthy, especially given that in some of these like key swing states, candidates win by just a few thousand votes.
Right. And I mean, we talk about this all the time in politics, that votes come down to the margin. So tell us where these voters could make a big difference.
I mean, look at Arizona and Georgia. Biden won both these states by a little over 10,000 votes. And between 2016 and 2020, nearly 100,000 people became naturalized citizens in Georgia, and 60,000 did in Arizona. So immigration advocates see the potential here. Nicole Malaku runs the National Partnership of New Americans.
You look at the math there and you can ascertain that if people were engaged, they would have a decisive impact. So you can take any part of the country and you could see what role immigrants and naturalized voters would play in this year's election.
That said, you know, it is unclear how many of those new citizens are actually registered to vote. The census just doesn't keep that data. And we don't have updated state-by-state numbers yet on naturalization since 2020.
Right. And we heard her say there, if they were engaged, they could have a big impact. So I want to ask you, Elena, are there challenges to getting these people engaged?
Yeah. I mean, according to the Pew Research Center, new citizen voters cast ballots at lower rates than U.S.-born voters. And Malaku argued it's a group that often is just overlooked by politicians.
People just tend to lump immigrants in one category of like people that are hard to reach. And so new American voters, often the messages aren't resonating.
She says there are lots of ways, though, to try to mend some of these gaps. She's pushing for actions to just make voting more accessible for new citizens, like increasing civic education around casting ballots early and offering ballots in more languages.
Right. And Elena, as you were sketching out for us, this is a group of people that come from different places all over the world. Mm-hmm. They live all over this country. Is there a way to see how this group votes?
Right. And this is a group that holds a wide range of political beliefs. I mean, there's just not a lot of data on how new citizens vote, but we can look at groups that we know they're a part of. You know, like Asian Americans and Latinos have broadly trended Democratic, but it's changing within some communities. Like if you look at South Florida, an area with large immigrant populations, notably Latino Americans, it was once considered to be a swing area in a swingy state, and now it's pretty solidly red. And on the issues, you know, in new polling from the National Partnership of New Americans, which focused on a handful of swing states, these new citizens prioritize similar issues as the rest of the country. It's issues related to the economy, yet again, followed by immigration.
NPR's Elena Moore, thank you.
Thanks.
Consider this. As we follow the ups and downs of the upcoming presidential election, there's a place to track those developments. It's the same place you can learn about the history-making election in Mexico, where a woman has just been elected president for the first time ever. Or where you can learn about the Pentagon's efforts to cut healthcare costs and how that might hurt battlefield medicine in a future war. That place is our Consider This newsletter. We look at one big topic that matters to you every day, plus joy and stories about humanity. The Consider This newsletter gives you the tools you need to be informed and navigate life's questions. You can subscribe at npr.org/consider this newsletter. And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The U.S. women's national team has been dominant on the global soccer stage for a long time. It has won World Cups and Olympic gold medals. But another U.S. squad is just as successful and virtually unknown. The U.S. women's deaf soccer team has not lost a match since it started playing in 2005. Over the weekend, the squad played a historic match against Australia. Colorado Public Radio's Tony Gorman was there.
It was a small but loud crowd outside Denver that turned out to watch the first ever U.S. women's deaf soccer match played in the U.S.
Today marks a landmark day between U.S. soccer and its extended national teams as world powerhouse U.S. women's deaf national team put their 37-0-1 record on the line for the first time on American soil.
The team has won 4 Deaf Olympic gold medals and 3 World Deaf Football Championships. So how is deaf soccer played? It looks like typical soccer, but each player must have a hearing loss of 55 decibels in their better hearing ear. All hearing devices must be removed prior to each match. The referee still blows a whistle, but also carries a flag to visually start and stop play. Colorado native Mia White felt strange returning to her home state to play for the team. Through an interpreter, the defender says it's still amazing.
I grew up here. I remember this field when I was a child, so it's odd, but it's great. I'm really humbled to be back.
The squad is coached by Amy Griffin. She played for the U.S. women's national team and won a Women's World Cup title in 1991. She says coaching this team is an ongoing learning experience.
I'm not at all fluent, but the players make me feel appreciated for trying. And I get better every camp. I get better, and hopefully I'll continue to improve.
Both men's and women's deaf teams play for the U.S. Soccer Federation's extended national teams. These include athletes who are visually impaired, with cerebral palsy, or in wheelchairs. The team doesn't play in the Paralympics because there are no classifications for deafness. While the match against Australia was played in a mostly empty stadium, it didn't matter to a group of hard-of-hearing spectators who celebrated each U.S. goal by raising their hands. 10-year-old Gia McCarthy, who was born deaf and speaks through an adult interpreter, is more excited to learn more about the sport now.
So I play on other sports teams, and so I learned about them, and I want to learn how to play defense and run better, and so I'm here to watch them.
She saw a clinic. The U.S. defeated Australia 11-0. Emily Spreeman set an American single-game scoring record in an 11-on-11 international match with 6 goals. That's for men and women, with or without hearing.
I just hope that this inspires the future generation of deaf girls and boys everywhere.
For now, the team is focused on next year, when the Deaf Olympics will be held in Tokyo and the U.S. is aiming to win a 5th gold medal. For NPR News, I'm Tony Gorman in Denver.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:48. Julie Deppisch is back with traffic with something on the roads in San Jose.
Yeah, pretty busy in the South Bay. Now we've got a motorcycle crash, South 101 and McKee Road, that's blocking the left lane. Very slow, back to Trimble. And southbound Guadalupe Parkway, it's after the 280 split. That crash remains in the left lane. Traffic stopped back to 101. We've got trouble in Mountain View, North 101 at Old Middlefield. 3 vehicles here. 2 right lanes are blocked. A heavy backup to Ellis. Julie Deppisch for KQED.
Thanks, Julie. Talk to you again at 4:59. Support for KQED comes from Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis. Visitors can explore Deborah Butterfield. P.S. These are not horses. On view now through June 24th, 2024. VisitorsCoverage.com, offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com.
I'm Danielle Venton, science reporter for KQED. A scientist trying to explain climate change has thought hard about which visuals to use. Maybe a tattoo would help?
Because I'd want to add a data point every couple of years, you know. So then I thought, well, maybe it'll go up my neck and I don't know.
A walking tour at Crissy Field, focused on climate change. You can find that story at kqed.org.
I'm Marisa Lagos. Today on Political Breakdown, direct democracy means that California voters are used to seeing a crowded ballot. This fall, we could be weighing in on more than a dozen ballot measures. We'll talk about what initiatives may and may not appear before voters in the November election. Plus, we're interviewing all the leading candidates for mayor of San Francisco. Got a question? You can send us an email at politicalbreakdown@kqed.org. It's Political Breakdown today at 5:50 on KQED Public Radio.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The United Nations tribunal that was tasked with finding and prosecuting war criminals from the former Yugoslavia and the Rwandan genocide has finally wrapped up major operations nearly 30 years after it was created. 2 remaining suspects, both suspected of committing genocide in Rwanda, were determined to have died, and the last living suspect to be found by the tribunal's tracking team was arrested last year in South Africa. Kelly McEvers and a team of filmmakers have been following these trackers over the past couple of years, and Kelly joins me now. Hi there.
Hi.
So Kelly, can you just start off by telling us briefly what this UN tribunal is and what makes it so special?
So this tribunal is sort of the last remaining vestige of 2 tribunals that were set up in the 1990s to deal with the war in the former Yugoslavia and after the Rwandan genocide. They're known as the ad hoc tribunals. And unlike other international courts, they have the backing of the Security Council, which carries a lot of weight. I think at the time in the 1990s, people thought that these ad hoc tribunals were going to become the norm. Of course, now we know that they're the anomaly. These two tribunals accounted for roughly 250 individuals from both of these conflicts, and now, nearly 30 years later, they're wrapping up their major operations.
And Kelly, you were following some trackers as they were searching for a fugitive. Can you tell us who he is and how they were able to find him?
They found him through meticulous work. This man's name was Fulgence Kayishima. He was a local leader in a Rwandan village called Nyanje. And in the early days of the Rwandan genocide, he and other local leaders are alleged to have ordered Tutsis in the village to shelter inside of a church, leading them to believe that they would be safe, and then later attacking the church and eventually ordering a bulldozer to destroy the church with more than 2,000 people inside. We actually went to Nyanje and talked to people who survived this massacre. We talked to a man named Fredouard Maniguha. He was an altar boy at the church. He was a Hutu, so he was spared. And he told us how, after the church was destroyed, Kayishima and other local leaders sat and celebrated.
And they sit down, they drink liquors and slaughter some of the goats, and they'll eat, you know, just trying to celebrate what they've achieved.
That's him speaking through an interpreter. And so after the genocide, Kayishima fled Rwanda. He went to the Democratic Republic of Congo. He eventually ended up in Mozambique, spent time in Eswatini, eventually goes to South Africa under a false name, claiming to be a Burundian refugee. And the tracking team found him living with a white family in South Africa and working on a winery. They drove up to the house one day and had figured out that he was actually Fulgence Kayishima and told him that he was under arrest, and he's currently in custody in South Africa.
Wow, what an incredible story. So I understand that these tribunals, they're now ending their major operations. Tell us what happens next.
So there are still some 1,200 suspects at large from the Rwandan genocide. And so this team is going to now assist the Rwandan government in tracking down some of these fugitives and bringing them to trial.
So there aren't any more ad hoc tribunals, as you're mentioning, but I want to understand, what does this mean for current efforts at international justice and prosecution of war crimes? I'm thinking about places like Syria, Ukraine, perhaps now even the war in Gaza.
I talked about this with Serge Brammertz. He's the chief prosecutor of this tribunal. And here's what he said.
I would say 20 years ago, many of us were thinking we will change the world, right? We will really try to implement the never again idea, which was so present in the public domain. Today, I'm much more realistic, and I'm going from case to case, right? And each individual case is really a major success.
Like, more countries are trying these suspects under what is known as universal jurisdiction, say when a German court tries a Syrian who's suspected of war crimes. And so this is what Brammert says he's focusing on now. You know, he says, it's hard for people who are seeking justice in current conflicts to wait as long as 30 years in some of these cases. But he says justice is still justice, no matter how long it takes.
Thank you, Kelly.
You're welcome.
That's Kelly McEvers, host of NPR's Embedded podcast.
Movies can be powerful cultural messengers for ideas, behaviors, and values. But a team of researchers says the movies of the last decade or so have missed an opportunity because very few of them address the urgency of climate change. The researchers surveyed 250 of the most popular movies between 2013 and 2022, and NPR's Catherine Fink dug into what they found.
Over the last 10 years or so, the reality of our warming climate has cropped up in some unexpected places, like Pokemon Detective Pikachu from 2019.
At this point, how can you not believe in climate change?
Or Kingsman Secret Service from 2014.
Climate change is a threat which affects us all, Mr. Valentine.
Or 2022's Glass Onion.
I'm a hard line on climate change. If that scares you, go stick your head back in the sand.
Each of these movies passed the climate reality check. That's a new metric modeled after the Bechdel test, which measures the representation of women in film. The climate reality check evaluates whether a movie acknowledges the reality of climate change. And there are basically just two requirements. One, climate change has to exist. And two, a character has to know about it.
It is an incredibly low bar. And then you actually look at the number of films, the percentage of films that are passing it, and it's still shockingly low.
Matthew Schneider Mayerson of Colby College in Maine is one of the developers of the Climate Reality Check, alongside the storytelling consultancy Good Energy. He spent his whole summer watching movies, and his team found that fewer than 10% of those movies cleared the bar. But the ones that did mention climate change actually fared better commercially than those that did not. Schneider-Mayerson and his collaborators say, based on their findings, Hollywood shouldn't be afraid of climate narratives, even if they're dark or depressing, because they're clearly resonating with viewers.
Most audiences would like to see their reality reflected on screen. You know, I think for most of us, increasingly climate change is a part of that reality.
Schneider-Mayerson says the inclusion of climate change in popular films more than doubled between 2013 and 2022. And the types of movies also expanded. Superhero films were a mainstay at first, and then...
In the second half of the decade, we did see, you know, climate change appearing in people's daily lives in sort of more quotidian ways. And I think that's a really important development.
Take the romantic drama Marriage Story from 2019. Adam Driver's character is constantly flicking off the lights.
He's energy conscious.
Schneider-Mayerson says the most impactful way to address climate change on screen is by modeling individual and collective action. He hopes that's where more movies are headed next.
You know, if we see characters that are living slightly different lives, it's likely to normalize it for folks and hopefully to lead to more acceptance and practicing of these climate positive behaviors.
So that's the power of storytelling on screen. But meanwhile, there's the climate footprint of the industry itself, which is massive for every film that's made. So when it comes to the reality of climate change in film, there's a good reason to ask what movies to make, but also how we should make them. Catherine Fink, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. The NPR Wine Club, where members can explore wines from around the world, and every purchase supports NPR's high-quality journalism. Available to adults 21 or older, nprwineclub.org. Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And the listeners of KQED. Julie Depesh is back, and we are off to Mountain View.